heavy piece up there. You hear about the Bakken Shale, which is up in the North Dakota area, more heavy on the what they call tight oil, which is tight oil, meaning that they basically recover the oil via this fracking process, and I'll talk about what that process is. You also hear a lot about the Barnett and the Eagle Ford, what they call plays, down in the Texas area as well. So those are kind of the big areas that people generally talk about. I'm going to talk about kind of fracking as a whole, and I'll dive in a little bit more and talk about some of the stuff going on in the Bakken Shale area in particular. And so most of the information I gather for this type of stuff, just so you know, you see I try to source all, that's EIA, the Energy Information Agency, which is part of the DOE, so they capture statistics on energy production, consumption, that sort of thing. So what is fracturing? What is fracking? Originally developed in 47, basically you take a mixture of water, sand, and some chemicals, and they would shoot it down into wells to basically induce fracturing, a little seismic activity in the ground that would create fissures that would then release oil or gas. And what they'd also do in that second bullet, they actually also would force sand and actually some ceramic materials into the cracks actually to keep them open so they keep the materials flowing.
Can you see
the one? Sorry. First successful commercial application, Halliburton did some work with it in 49. Then more recently, when it really became active, was when they invented a couple additional things. One was directional drilling. So this is where they actually, you know, drill down basically like almost 10,000 feet vertically, then shoot about 2 miles horizontally as well using flexible tubing. The second big thing, which actually made it more profitable, was they started doing these perforations in the piping, and then they started using these blockages where they could go in there and actually block up parts of the pipe, and they could make much larger cracks, much larger fissures in there that could then release more oil, so they get more bang for their buck. So that's kind of in a nutshell what fracking is. What does it kind of look like? Here's a schematic Popular Mechanics put out. So obviously you have your rig up there, you're going down. Your typical aquifer sits up here, much higher. These guys go down again about 2 miles down, and they can shoot across about 2 miles as well. And they show a little kind of blow up of, you know, some of the perforated holes and whatnot. I don't know if they actually show the blocking mechanisms in here, but you know, basically the fluid shoots up out of those perforations, creates the cracks in there. And these are small seismic activities. They typically measure about, you know, 1.5 to 2 on the Richter scale. So you don't really notice them above ground, but the USGS has noticed a few of them, apparently, in some of their seismic activity monitoring. So it's always a little worrisome that we're inducing little earthquakes, but, you know, whatever. So, you know me, I like charts. So I'm going to walk through just some of the kind of the oil statistics that we get up here. So I'm really going to focus on the type oil piece. So fracturing, again, a type, it applies to both gas and oil. I'm really going to focus on the oil piece. Generally speaking, this is our kind of, in U.S. crude oil production, we typically have two types of crude oil, right? We have Brent crude oil, which is a particular type of light crude oil. Then we have the West Texas Intermediate, WTI crude oil, which is actually a lighter type of crude even. But this is the typical production curve that we have seen over the U.S. We see that peak, again, what I mentioned before, in 72, and we've been declining ever since. But then you see the big uplift there for the past 4 or 5 years. Again, 2005, we got the directional drilling, so we got the horizontal drilling. 2009, we got the multi-stage fracking. So we've seen increases there. We're measuring it here in thousands of barrels, right? So you're seeing basically 4 billion. So the peak was about, I don't know, it's like 3.6 billion barrels per year. That equates to about 9.6 million barrels per day. So I'll flip between a few different measurements here.
And while you look at that chart, of course, it doesn't go into the future. Is the projection that will
fall? I'll show you what that looks like here.
Okay,
in the chart or two. So then we kind of zoom in a little bit on that chart. So this is, we're actually looking at barrels per day now. So that is correct. Those are just millions of barrels per day. So you see 83, you know, 87 or so, we were about 9 million barrels. Today we're at about 7.5. Okay, so we're climbing it a little bit. And they project it's going to climb a bit more. So that, and that one was overall crude oil, right? That wasn't just from the fracking, but that was all the conventional wells that are out there as well. Deep water horizons type stuff as well. In particular for the tight oil, again, tight oil is just what they call the fracking, the oil that's produced from fracking technology. So the tight oil production you see, now we're in thousands of barrels. I'm sorry for all the different scales. But so this is basically, 1 million, 1.2 million. So you see we're sitting at about 1.3 million or so, which are the current estimates. You also see where the big play is out there, right? We see that the Bakken is really the biggest play. Eagle Ford down in Texas is the next biggest.
So what percentage of U.S. production is coming?
This is what, 1.3 million out of about a 7.5 million. Round up to 1.5, so you're like a fifth of the production, give or take. Another thing, and I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about here about, we have production levels and we have price levels, right? So here's just the price of the Brent crude. The WTI crude is it varies. It's a little bit different, but usually a little bit lower, a little cheaper. But it kind of gets in the wash there. But so you see, we had the big spike in oil and the food price indicator, food price index that the UN puts up. And once you hit about $100 a barrel, that's when you saw the more regional instabilities occurring around the world. So that's kind of a magic marker right there. So you'd ask a little bit about projections. So we've got a couple of things showing here. One are, here's our oil pricing over here, right? So we're, if we shoot out here, and actually what we're showing here are both the Brent and the West Texas prices here and those two things. But, we're sitting here in the 100, 120 range right there. And you see there, this is again EIA projecting out where the prices, those look like pretty nasty prices going up in my opinion. But whatever, that's just some random linear projection. Then you get our production here, and our production, you see our scale over on the right, that's again millions of barrels per day, they say we're producing. So we're sitting up here at the, this is I guess a year or so old, but sitting up here at the 6.5-7 million, and they're projecting it's going to go up some, but middle of the century, or middle of the decade, middle to the end of the decade, we're going to peak out about 7.5 million, they're thinking. And there's a reason for that. A couple reasons. One is, tight oil is fundamentally different in terms of its production levels than conventional oil. Conventional oil will pump for a while, right? And it'll flow for a while at a pretty high production level. Tight oil will decrease very quickly. So it'll you'll get an initial burst out, but then it falls dramatically. So here you see kind of a typical decline curve for a Bakken well. So, if we're producing 500 barrels a day and maybe initially, within 12 months, we're already down to, a third of that. Well, you see the declines. The first year declining 60, almost 70%, and you just keep declining from there. So you get an initial gush, and then it declines very quickly. So what do you have to do to keep production levels up? You got to drill more, right? So the challenge here, though, is pretty soon you run out of drilling space, right? And so what are we seeing here? We're seeing a couple of things. We're seeing kind of the production levels versus the number of wells drilled. Well, the geologists want to have done estimates in the back end play, basically saying, hey, we think you're basically going to peak out at available well sites at about the 12, a little shy of 12,000 wells, and that you're going to peak out at that in about 5 years, well, 2013, 4 years from now. So basically at that point, we're going to have drilled all we could drill in the back end play. And you're going to peak out your production, barrels per day. So at what, let's just say it's 1 million barrels, right? For that one play, and then you're declining after that. So you've heard these people saying we've got 100 years of oil and all that. If these estimates hold even remotely to be true, it's just not the case. We're going to run out. They actually are calling probably within 10 years we'll have an oil bust. Oil boom right now, your classic kind of boom and bust cycle. We've got an oil boom right now, we'll probably have a bust in about 10 years because we'll suck these plays dry. 10, 15 years, I don't know. I mean, it's tough to totally estimate it, but.
So where is 100 years going to come from?
Where are the 100 year estimates? I think part of the 100 year, well, a lot of people they've had like about 3 or 4 big projections as to how much oil they think are in these shells, right? And initially they started out with, USGS had a pretty large one, and these things, I mean, no one knows for sure, right? But they've considerably shrunk that estimate more recently. They also, when they make a lot of these projections, if you look what the typical oil companies or what the industries make projections, they make projections, you know, that you're going to have more kind of straight growth, like linear growth, in terms of the number of wells you can actually produce. But they haven't gone back. I mean, these are actually more like some of the geologists coming back and saying, hey, you're going to be limited in the number of wells you can produce. But these, a lot of the energy companies are still saying, hey, you're going to be able to just grow in 20. I think the estimate I saw from like North Dakota Department of Mining and Natural Resources was that they would be able to get like 35 to 40,000 wells out there. That's extremely different than 12,000 wells, right? That's three or four times the estimate out there that these guys are making. So, you know, it's kind of like whose numbers do you start trusting after a while? And so I generally go with the more conservative numbers here, because a lot of those initial estimates are super inflated for economic reasons. And so I would tend to look at that number as a more accurate number, especially now that you've seen like USGS revive their overall estimates for how much oil they think might be out there in these shells.
Could the oil companies be purposely overestimated?
I mean,
keep us dependent.
Well, I don't know. You know, they're always going to estimate, be optimistic about how much production they have out there, I think.
Yeah, I had a question. In one of these wells that goes down, how much area does that actually drain? Because the fracking only breaks the shale in the local area around the well. And I was just wondering how far out that...
They say, I'm not sure how far out, you know, you come down, you go out that way. They'll go about 200 meters up and down from it. I'm not sure exactly how wide out they go into the shell. It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for it.
And can they drill the same site and make it go a different way? And
Fred, I guess not that you can redrill a site, but that you can frack it 10 times or so, frack a single well?
Yeah, well, they actually frack it even more than that. They'll frack it, you know, where is it? A number of times, right? It's about 10 times. Now you say that. It's about every 1,000 feet they'll frack it. That's that multi-stage fracking. They'll frack along the way. Again, they go about 2 miles, about 10,000 feet. So about 10 times they'll frack it, stop it up, frack it, and that'll allow them to get deeper fissures into the ground. Or, you know, they're basically, the back and play, they're like two shell levels that they go after. There's one kind of above and below where the actual drilling occurs. And so they end up fracking in both directions. What they don't know is, you know, that direction. I'm not sure how far they actually go out. I have to imagine it's probably, if they're going, I have to imagine it's probably a circular thing, right? I have to imagine it's probably about 150 meters all around in a circular fashion. The radius is probably 150 meters. It's an interesting question. It's like how much can you keep going down? You know, how close can you get to this thing? I don't have a good answer.
They went
for
out
that
way or that way. Or...
Yeah, I mean, you actually look at like. In fact, I've got it in a backup slide. You see kind of these maps. North Dakota does a pretty good job of putting out in an ArcGIS server of. You hear all the well locations and hear all the horizontal lines. You can just see it just like littered with lines. All throughout there, and you know, they're 2 mile lines in all these various directions, and it becomes a geometry problem almost at one point. You know, how many of these can you lay on top of each other?
Before the earth settles and leaves you in a sinkhole,
yeah, right before Bismarck starts sinking 200 meters into the ground.
Has there ever been a study or a speculation as to whether the oil is a necessary commodity for the earth?
Oh, gosh. Do other things use it, consume it, need it, et cetera?
Or even for this, as some kind of a structural benefit? I've always wondered, I'm here, you're taking a bunch of stuff out.
You're sucking it out.
What was it there for?
And then you put water in it.
Well, things died. Things, you know, got turned into oil over long periods of time and whatnot. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for you on that one. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, the dinosaurs died for us.
Yeah, is this another another thing that, you know, 50 years from now we realize that we really screwed up the system?
Yeah, are we disrupting the ecology in yet another way such that we don't realize the second and third order effects? Yeah. Possibly. I don't have a good answer for it.
Sir?
Have you seen any parallels between what's happening here in North Dakota and what happened back in the 80s to the oil shale industry of western Colorado? And what did the price of oil change drastically back in the 1980s, if it changed drastically right now, like it did back in Colorado times, do you see that this whole back and field could become a bust, just like it did in Colorado?
Well, I mean, I think if you dropped, I think, in fact, when I get to the next several slides, I'll re-show a few slides from the first day. When you start looking at the energy return on investment, i.e. how much energy do you have to put in for versus how much do you get out, shell oil, tight oil is pretty low value there. So if the oil prices drop a decent way, it's not going to be profitable to do it.
As far as the oil prices are concerned, this goes on to the world market, right? I mean, we in the United States as consumers, we don't benefit from this at all, other than there might be more oil in the world market for a period of time. But then China and India are using more oil, and so this isn't going to decrease the price of gasoline at the pumps.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we just set a price, right? We don't. It's not like we've nationalized our oil resource.
Right.
I mean, we do have a strategic petroleum reserve where we maintain a 30-day supply of oil, but that, you know, by no means do we set the price of oil by some national policy or whatnot.
Right.
I mean,
so
that's a
as an individual in the United States, this doesn't affect my purchase of gasoline at all.
I mean, if you have more, it's a supply and demand thing. I mean, if there's more oil available on the marketplace,
your China
prices
are
going to
be cheaper.
I mean, it's a reason. Like, I mean, we've got
it. Part of it, supply and demand. China and India.
Right.
Using
their supply is increasing significantly. Right. I mean, our supply, their demand
right.
is increasing
right.
significantly.
Right.
right. Our demand is it's been decreasing a bit recently because of the recession. But they anticipate as, you know, the economy warms back up, that that'll basically resume to normalcy. But, yeah, I mean, China's really the worrisome one, right? As their standard of living increases, more and more people want cars, more and more, you know, which in turn means more and more oil that they want to consume. So, yeah, I mean, that's definitely a big concern area. I think that one, and then India shortly behind it, would be what kind of break that consumption production levels for the world as a whole. I mean, if you remember before, I kind of showed where we were basically at the world level, where we were sitting at like the 89 million barrels per day of consumption and production, pretty much riding each other, very close. But the concern is always is what happens when your production just dips a little bit from what your consumption requires? You know, do you also have countries, say, trying to nationalize their oil resources? And you know, what type of a scare would that do then throughout the marketplace? So.
Well, on that back end play, how much? It spans both Canada and U.S. How much has it been drilled in the Canadian side? Is it equal, or have they developed as much?
You know, I don't know.
Is that the Alberta oil sands?
No, that's different, actually. It's even a lower quality ROI. I'm not sure. It's a good question. I'm just not sure. I haven't really looked in the Canadian side of it too much. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a fairly big chunk across the border there, so I would imagine that it's going to be, I have to imagine it's well tapped as well, right? Probably at the same pace of this. In fact, there's some of those newer techniques like the multi-stage fracturing, I mean, those were actually produced in Canada by some Calgary folks. And so I have to imagine that those are in use in the back end up there as well. Let's see, where were we? We talked about crude oil, we talked about the projections, the decline curve, kind of the well space. We talked about this a little bit, the kind of the energy return on investment before. Remember when you first had oil gushing out in the 30s, you got like 100-to-1 return. You could tap in there, oil started flowing, right? As we progressed and we had domestic oil being produced in the 70s, we were at like a 40-to-1 return, right? We kept progressing. We got to domestic oil in 2000. Now we're sitting here at, 10 or so. But that's even before. And so you ask about like the tar sands and stuff like that, right? It's anywhere from, these are, you know, some uncertainty bars basically, but anywhere from like basically, you know, a little over 1 to maybe 4 or 5 in terms of your EROI. But then when you come
so,
to your,
I'm so sorry. How is it that the oil companies are making such unbelievable profits
Well, we're still above the one ratio, right? You're still able to do it for cheaper. You're still able to extract it for cheaper than it costs you can extract for cheaper than it costs to extract, right? It's still cheaper to extract than what you're getting paid for based on the price per oil, right? So if those $120 prices of oil significantly drop, then they run into problems. But right now, it's still profitable for them. So when you look at the oil shell, then you see your EROIs. The best estimates out there via some recent reports are 1.7 to 2.1 type of ratio. So you're getting to the point where, you know, how much longer can you go at that rate? How much longer can it actually be profitable? And so that was at the wellhead itself, right? And then again, once you've done the refining as well, it even drops a little bit more for those. And again, these are studies, these are estimates that folks are making.
You know, are they, when you go by those wells, they're burning off a lot of natural gas in a lot of those. Are they capturing any or very much natural gas?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, in fact, you know, they definitely try to. One of the big concerns out there environmentally is the leakage of natural gas, right? They're basically leaking methane,
yeah,
which is about five times as corrosive to the environment as CO2. But they definitely do capture natural gas, especially in like the Marcellus Shell. I mean, that's the primary thing they capture is natural gas. But even in the back end as well, they're capturing gas. It's not nearly to the same extent as the oil production, though. Is there a question?
Yeah, I was reading recently that the oil prices are actually very artificial. They're keeping the prices up to cover their costs, especially on some of this new exploration and all the stuff they're moving. And that, you know, it's a house of cards.
Yeah, I mean, it's become so much more expensive for the extraction costs anymore. I mean, when you're drilling like the Deepwater Horizon, drilling 26,000 feet into the ocean to get oil, it's so different than, you know, tapping into Pennsylvania and having gushing oil come out like it did 100, you know, or 80 years ago. It's just night and day. And so that EROI, I mean, that's really going to become a key player here. I don't know where the profitability breaks there, I guess. I tried to actually go and look at some of I wanted to figure out, yeah, because I think you raised that question last time on Monday, Daryl, about how are they even making a buck still if the EROI is so low. I wanted to try to look that up and get that to you, but I ran out of time. Sorry. But it's a great question. I think that it's one that needs to be answered because, you know, if you're getting a 1-to-1 ratio, you're putting in, you know, if it's taking me one barrel of oil to get one barrel out, what's the point at that point? Basically, you're at a net loss overall, right? Because you have environmental factors as well. The metals would not do it. So, but for those coming out of South Dakota, the average graduate can get paid more than a Harvard graduate these days. So that's good news, right? So there's good economic benefits. I thought that was an interesting little story. But so the median student coming from South Dakota School of Mines and Technology can make $57,000 versus a Harvard grad can make $54,000 on average. So there's a lot of money being poured into North and South Dakota these days because of this. Well, someone was saying a $250 night for a room in Bismarck.
It wasn't Bismarck, it was at the border.
Is at the border, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of wealth going around there. So we talked about the economics. I just wanted one quick slide. There are obviously a bunch of environmental concerns. So, I mean, you're taking water, salt, and chemicals, shooting into the ground, creating seismic activities. Then that's coming back as wastewater, right? So you have to do something with that wastewater. That's a big issue. Actually, we talked about, I showed you in that one slide where you have the aquifer at like the 2,000 foot level. These guys are going down 2 miles. There's a lot of concern that there's actually leakage making its way into the aquifer as well. I mentioned the methane gas leakage. Again, methane gas, five times more potent than CO2, and if this stuff's spewing off, also you're increasing your warming. There's actually also concern about radioactivity being released as you're pulling stuff out. And then finally, the seismicity as well. Even though it's pretty small on the Richter scale, there, like I said, the USGS actually has measured some of these things. and felt about like the 3 and 4 on the Richter scale. So I think that's all I had on fracking. Any other questions?
So they're just shooting that water in there and leaving it then down there?
No, they pull it back out. The water
what are the
back.
Chemicals?
They're not quite they don't the chemicals yet. not all of them.
Not all of them are bad. Some of them are considered carcinogenic, though. I don't remember what the chemicals are. There are a lot of them. They're like, there's a list of like 2,500 chemicals that one can use in the fracking process. And Congress labeled like 650 of those as carcinogenic. So about a quarter of them as being somewhat bad for us. There's a whole listing out there, something called like MSDS, where they list out where the minimum safety standard designations are. If you're really interested, we can go
material safety and yeah.
There you go. You know better than I do, but exactly where they actually call out what are the chemicals and whatnot. So,
what's the controversy over the sand? I grew up in the Mississippi Valley in Wisconsin.
The tar sands?
And no, the there's
special sand.
Yeah, they're mining quarries along the Mississippi. It's exactly the right sand to use in the fracking, and so they're shipping that sand out to North Dakota, but there's regionally controversy over that.
Is it a more of an ecological controversy of like stripping ecosystems and stuff like that, or is it
maybe it is the development of the quarries, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just not very familiar with that, unfortunately. But I'm not even sure like if it's a certain grade of sand that one wants probably, or it sounds like it
it's
like that might be a good supply.
A sandstone, a certain sandstone.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of silica. I don't know what the
vitamin is. I'm just curious. Okay, so that's fracking. So I thought I'd show you quickly what we've got a few minutes left here. So we moved here from Arlington, Mass, and we put in a geothermal heating system, a geo-exchange heating system, also known as a geothermal system. If I kind of walk through what that project was, and just because we're talking about energy, and it's an interesting supply of heat and air conditioning for our home. So, what is a geothermal system? It's really one of the most environmentally friendly and a highly efficient way to heat and cool a house, right? Technically, it's called a geo-exchange heating systems, right? Geothermal is what you find in like Iceland, where you get these springs and stuff like that, right? But this is a geo-exchange system where you're basically leveraging the constant temperature of the earth at like 54 degrees and leveraging that to do an exchange process, basically a heat exchange process. That's what it is in a nutshell. That's a heat pump, right? Basically, you're taking in 54 degrees water from the well, number one. You're basically transferring heat, ground energy, the heat, to the refrigerant in the heat pump. It comes over where that refrigerant is compressed, which basically raises the temperature, right? This is thermodynamics. The heat is transferred to the heating air. Then the heat is transferred to the room by, handler and ductwork. Cool air is returned, and it's causing the refrigerant to condense. We come down to number 7, where the refrigerant expands, causing it to cool further. And then you actually can return stuff to the well, basically. And there are multiple types of well, or multiple types of these systems. There are what they call open loop systems, where you actually have a well like this, an open well. There are closed loop systems as well, where you're just basically using refrigerant throughout the whole system, but it's still going down into a borehole, basically, because you're still doing that exchange with the ground heat down there.
Oh, we did it at a church in Duluth, and all that was church was on like a little island in kind of a swampy area.
Yeah.
So they buried this black plastic pipe and coils of it.
So they did a horizontal one.
Just threw it down in there, covered it back up.
Yep.
And then the water level, would come up, and so it was a closed system.
That was a closed horizontal system, is what it sounded like. So you can. It's a great point. You can do horizontal ones, which is like I said, if you have a lot of land area, you can dig up the earth. Bury it. How far did they bury it? Probably 6 feet or so, something like that.
It was maybe 8 or
yeah.
8 to 10
feet. Yeah,
below
a freeze line type of thing. Yeah. And so you can do that where it's a closed loop. You can also then do the vertical where you do boreholes, you can do either open or closed loop. And you can also do them where they're horizontal, but you actually tap into like a pond, actually, as well, and you can tap into water that way.
Yeah.
So there are a few different techniques. Background on the house is, our house was like a 1950-year-old house, about 1,500 square feet. We had an old 60s gas-fired boiler, radiant steam, $250 a month, over the years, so about $3,000 a year. We kept the temperature at 64 degrees, right? So it was nice and warm, good New England hardiness there, right? chilly, clanking radiators. It only heated about two-thirds of the house, so poor Ari, our response to "I'm cold" was, "Here's another blanket." that's just the way it was. We had no air conditioning at the time. So I thought you'd like a chart of natural gas prices. They're just growing over the past 20 years as well, right? And so we were trying to figure out, by going with the geo-exchange system, we're using strictly electricity for the heating. We weren't using any natural gas or any type of oil. Oops, going the wrong way. So what did we do? We put in a standing well, 4 to 6 feet deep, 2 grounds for seat pumps, ductwork, and remove all the radiators. And basically the costing was about a third for each of those components. And I'll show you what the overall cost is in a moment. It's kind of a boom when you first see the cost, but it's not as bad as one thinks. Overall cost is $45,000 to do it. However, right off the bat, you got a 30% tax credit from the feds. So that knocked off $13,000 to $14,000. You got a 0% loan from the state. So that was another $15,000, and then a home equity line, whatever. You see your energy consumption. So before I was burning, 192 million BTUs, whereas now I'm an order of magnitude cheaper in terms of my energy consumption. So about 20 million BTUs. You see my first year savings right there is about $1,400 a year. So the payback is about 12 to 15 years, assuming that the 5 to 10% energy inflation. So if you happy snaps, obviously you bring the drilling and whatnot, the ductworks, the heat pumps. And we basically had split, so one, we had the heat pump and the air handler for the first floor is all here. Here we had the heat pump downstairs and we had the air handler upstairs in the attic. So it was a split operation.
Each you one, did this all yourself, right?
What's that?
You did this all yourself.
I didn't personally do it.
Your spare time.
No. You wouldn't see that $45,000 figure if I did this by myself. I paid someone to do all this. I'm really documenting what they did. So look at your energy costs, right? So I'm showing basically a combination of both gas and electricity costs, right? So the red being the electricity, the blue being the gas. You see my winter months, we had huge peaks, spiking going on right there. When I put in the geothermal HVAC, all of a sudden you saw the gas costs reduced dramatically. I was only using gas for cooking, heating a hot water heater, that sort of thing. But you see the electricity costs actually go up because I'm doing the pumping now and the air handling. Then you can see that the cumulative energy usage throughout the year as well. So it's in 2010 was when I really jumped over, and you can see 2007 I was spending $4,200 per year on my overall energy usage. By 2010, I was, 2,300, say about $2,000 a year in overall energy consumption. And what the big difference was, so before I was using gas, 2009 I was using gas just at 64 degrees and only getting AC, right? And it was costing me about... I was only getting heating, excuse me. And we spent about $3,800. Now we're using geothermal, keeping the thermostat at 70 degrees, getting air conditioning as well, and we're only spending $2,400. So $1,400 cheaper, keeping it much warmer, plus getting air in the summer as well.
Does that cost reflect higher costs of electricity to run the system?
I basically transferred my cost from having to pay gas, now I'm just paying pure electrical costs. The geothermal mechanism, they basically calculate what's called a coefficient of performance as well for how efficient the systems are. Generally speaking, they're a lot more efficient than any gas or oil burning system.
Because you're using electricity to run the system.
Well, you're using electricity, but even the exchange process is a lot more efficient in terms of your heating and your cooling as well. And then also, we're saving reducing our CO2 generation as well by a lot. And then the you know, the O&M is pretty easy. You clean a couple of filters, an air handler filter, and then also filters and heat pumps as well. So that's it.
Was this a big bonus for you when you sold your house?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
The value goes with the house. How much did it cost to drill your 500 foot well?
It was part of that 45,000.
But you figure it was
about
a third.
I think it was about $12,000 or $13,000. That's what it was.
And to outrig it, rig it with whatever.
Yeah. Do all the testing and all that.
Horizontal's cheaper than vertical, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you need the land is a big thing, right? I mean, we were in a 0.1 acre lot, so it's very tight. Yeah, especially if it's a new construction, right? When you can move soil easily and just you dig it up and lay the coils, like Daryl was mentioning, put your soil back on top and you're done.
Is yours a closed loop?
Ours was open.
Were you in a residential area in the city?
Yeah, we're in Arlington.
Zoning prohibit that type of thing?
No, not in, I mean, pretty much most of the neighborhoods around where we were, they all allowed it.
Yeah, they had a permit.
Yeah, you had to get a permit to do it.
So
that was all handled by the company as well. They worked with the town and got all that. That was all part of that costing figure.
On open, what you're drawing water out and pumping water back?
You're drawing water out, right? And whether it's, if it's winter, I'm extracting heat from that water.
Right.
And then I'm returning basically the cool water back into the well.
Yeah, so
as it works its way back down, you know, things heat back up.
So,
and again, it's about 54 degrees constant.
It's a standard groundwater temperature of 54 degrees.
Right.
Yeah, so it's a, what, zero exchange. You know, as much as you go out, you put right back in. In terms of
In terms of water, yeah. You can do a bleed off if you need to. If it's going to be really cold and it can't warm up fast enough when you're dumping stuff back in there, you can actually drain that off elsewhere. And so you might be drawing more than you're actually, you may not be in the
pool,
right? You might be drawing out more than you're actually putting back in. But we never actually got to that point. And I mean, it was Boston, right? It got cold. It got down to zero and, you know, pretty cool temperatures. But it still ran just fine. So, is there another question?
Yeah, were you comfortable with the register temperature inside the house, the air?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very different than radiant heat, right?
Yeah.
I mean, radiant heat, I don't know if you've ever had that, but it's wonderful temperature, right? I mean, you went to ductwork, so you kind of had to. But yeah, I mean, we could have even gone higher if we wanted to, right? That was just what we chose to kind of sit it at.
And what was your bottom, your coldest point that you could handle outside temperature-wise?
Well, I mean, I know it got to, like I said, it got to around 0 or 5 degrees. We didn't have any problem. Again, you pretty much don't, right? Because again, you're always pulling from 54 degrees, 460 feet down.
Yeah, just the capacity of the system.
Yeah,
producing.
Yeah. So that's kind of the beauty of it. So obviously, you guys have a heating challenge up here, Holden, in the winter. This requires electricity, which is a challenge as well, obviously, up here in the winter. So I don't know if that would be a viable option or not, but something to think about. There definitely have been some big installations I know of. I know like Trinity Church in the middle of Boston, Copley Plaza, did a geothermal system a number of years ago. And I mean, that's a big church. Lots of, you know, big ceilings and all that. And I don't remember how many ton heating capacity it required, but it was quite large. A lot of schools I know have done it back east as well. So, anyways.
You can use the existing forced air system, the ductwork.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we already had ductwork, that would cut a third of the price off.
Your costs.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was the well, it was a heat pump, and it was a ductwork and radiator. Those were kind of the three big costs. If you remove the ductwork issue, you remove a third of it. So, any questions, any comments? Anything on fracking you want to talk about? No.
Any way we can stop it?
I don't know how you'd stop it.
Yeah.
Boy, I was wondering, maybe mention it. What's the, how many million barrels a year are we consuming in the United States?
I think we're about, I think U.S. is, worldwide it's about 89 million. Remember, I want to say it's like 18 or 19 in the U.S.
So fracking is less than half of that. That
fracking.
Or not fracking, but domestic produced oil is less than half of our.
Our domestic produced oil is about 7 million, 7.5 million barrels.
Okay.
Fracking is only, well, they're going to estimate it's going to get about, be about a fifth of that.
But we're producing then less than half of what we consume.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually. Yes, yeah, we're producing about 30% of what we consume, now that I think of it. So it is about 18 or 19 million, I would say. So, yeah, obviously the vast majority is imports.
What are the implications of what we're talking about, fracking, when other nations are involved? Is that something that other nations are considering doing or using?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, I mean, I think other nations are using the technology already. A lot of it depends on, do they have the same geologic shell formations that we have as well, right? Obviously Canada does, so they can do it. I don't know worldwide who else are big users of it. Yeah, I haven't really looked at that.
So, is there like in the international governance of mining? So that sounds funny, but I know that the United States is pretty tight environmental boundaries that folks are working within,
right,
or attempting to.
Right.
But some of the poorer countries maybe don't have that in place, so they can be kind of taken advantage of. Or
right.
how do you deal with, how does the world deal with that?
Like exploitation of others?
Yeah, yeah.
Not very effectively right now, unfortunately. I mean, a big case in point is like Africa, right?
Yeah.
You see countries like China, we're doing huge plays in Africa.
Building a soccer field.
Well, it's interesting. I did some research for my work on that because you really saw, and they're doing it for a number of reasons, right? You see China, you see Saudi Arabia. You know, energy resourcing is a huge one. They go into places like Nigeria and really try to gobble up big energy resources. Food production is another big one. Saudi Arabia, until about 2005, was a food exporter. And then they drained their aquifers. In 2005, all of a sudden, became a food importer. And so China is facing the same thing. They're trying to buy land to grow so they can have crops. And they're doing these like 99-year leases, right? And just kind of, and part of the challenge is, some of these technologies, whatnot, they're consuming so much of the water and without really, being explicit about that when they're getting the lease. As a result, it's causing, drought and starvation for people downstream from that.
How does the United Nations play any role in any of this, or how?
They do. They do a lot of reports. UN always produces like 150 page plus report, it seems like, and they're good. They have good facts, but I internationally, I don't know how yet. There are some land grab sites out there, and people are trying to at least document. Hey, look at the exploitation that's going on out there. And again, it's for resources, for food, it's for energy, it's for water. I don't know. I still, if I look at like the environment, I still don't think the world is very serious, or at least the U.S. is not very serious about the environment yet. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, I hope the Obama administration, when they came in, there was some initial talk, like, oh, something. You heard like Mayor Bloomberg saying, yeah, we've got to get serious about this after Superstorm Sandy and all this type of stuff, but it just kind of fell out that fear as well.
They brought in Van Jones for about 3 months.
Yeah. I don't know how you tackle it.
How does an administration like the Obama administration accomplish that when you have a Congress which essentially works against him?
Are you asking me how do you fix the political system? Let's go get some ice cream next door.
I keep on hearing how the Obama administration said it was going to. But it can't do anything unless Congress.
Yeah, generally it doesn't show so.
Maybe we need some congressional fracking.
All right,
back off. If we drill one through Congress,
yeah,
we can send fracking. That might work, actually. The high production rate.
Did I hear you say at the beginning that they're projecting energy surplus in the United States?
No.
I heard something wrong.
You heard me say that.
Okay.
Maybe energy surplus, but I said that at every... I don't think so.
Okay.
This is very good. Thank you.
Yeah.